Welcome to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Florida is now the hotspot for the UK strain of COVID-19. Yeah, that's right. Almost 350 cases have been confirmed here by the Centers for Disease Control. That is actually twice the number found in the second leading state, California. And keep in mind, California has a much bigger population. Public health experts suspect the number of cases of this variant of the virus in Florida is actually much larger. Now, it's called the UK strain because that's where it was first found, and it is much more contagious. There are no new rules in place, but the Biden administration is discussing possible travel restrictions that could slow the spread of the virus here. That potential was met with furious opposition from leading Florida Republicans. Here's Governor Ron DeSantis on Thursday in Port Charlotte.
We will oppose it 100%. It would not be based in science. It would purely be a political attack against the people of Florida.
U.S. Senator Marco Rubio was also critical of talk of any travel restrictions to Florida.
It would be devastating to Florida's economy. It would be singling out this state. What appears to be some sort of punishment. It would be unsubstantiated by the science, and frankly, I think it's unconstitutional and illegal. You can't restrict the ability of Americans to travel within their own country, and they should abandon that idea immediately.
Ben Konark is a reporter at the Miami Herald, joins us now. Ben, what can you tell us about the Biden administration talking about some kind of travel restriction or restrictions?
Yeah, so I mean, it's important to keep this in context, right? So these are active discussions, but they're about kind of wide-ranging travel restrictions. You know, there's been a lot of kind of misinterpretation out there about whether this is a Florida travel ban. It isn't that, right? This is what we're talking about is most likely going to look like if it is implemented, which, you know, to be clear, nothing is imminent here. But if it were to be implemented, it would look something like what we had here for travelers from New York, back from late March to August, which is a quarantine requirement, or perhaps a testing requirement. So those are, you know, things that are viewed as within the jurisdiction of the federal government.
So I suppose one of the differences, though, was that was state requirement. Governor DeSantis put that requirement on New Yorkers traveling to Florida back in the springtime, didn't he?
Correct. Yes, that came from Governor Ron DeSantis. And also, you know, that was targeted to the tri-state area. That was right. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey.
Which at the time was experiencing the hot spot and saw unbelievable hospitalizations and fatalities from the virus.
Yes, at the outset, although I will remind everyone that was kept in place and even pointed to as a success well into the summer surge that developed around June here. So the difference, just to note really quickly, is that that was a geographically targeted restriction. What we're discussing would be public health related, right? It wouldn't target Florida necessarily, but it would say any state where, just hypothetically speaking, right? This percentage of new cases is made up of the variant that might trigger these restrictions. So maybe that would be Florida, which has the highest concentration of variant cases right now. If we're talking about B.1.1.7 or the UK variant, maybe it would be California, which has not an equally high, but still somewhat high prevalence of these variants. So that's really like kind of the contours of this discussion is all around the mutations that we're seeing in this virus, not just in the United States, but across the world. And that's, you know, causing a lot of concern right now.
And I want to ask you more about the variant, this UK variant in Florida in a moment. But back to this consideration, the White House, as you kind of alluded to, has been clarifying kind of this position that essentially saying nothing is off the table. And we have heard from Senator Rubio and Governor DeSantis pushing back very hard against any conversation about some kind of travel restriction. So separate kind of the politics, the personalities, and the science here for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really difficult thing to do, right?
Fair enough.
And unfortunately, right, because a lot of this pandemic, we've seen politics get intertwined. And so here you have, a report that the Biden administration is considering, or there are active conversations about potential travel restrictions And some of the responses he saw out of Florida Republicans were, you know, that this was a travel ban. Certainly the right wing part of Twitter was up in arms about this, saying it was unconstitutional. If anyone had bothered to read the article, they would see that we quoted several constitutional experts who said that it actually what we're talking about here isn't a ban, right? That would be unconstitutional if the federal government, or likely unconstitutional if the federal government said no one can travel to or from Florida. What we were discussing were kind of these broad public health restrictions, right? Testing requirements, quarantine requirements, stuff like that. So that is, I think, lost in a lot of the politics that's surrounding the story right now.
We have seen air passenger travel already pick up to some Florida airports as winter has taken hold up north and folks may be looking for a sunny escape from the weather, and also reputationally, the idea that there's fewer rules somehow in Florida, I think, has also made its rounds in some of the political strains of social media. But there has been this talk of requiring testing prior to getting on an airplane. Where does that consideration stand?
Well, you know, the Biden administration has proposed this, and I think they've gotten some pushback from the airline industry, which says a testing requirement isn't necessary. But getting back to your larger point about, you know, travel patterns to Florida, it's really good context and an important context about this conversation, right? We have a situation here in Florida where we've had a very different level of, you know, coronavirus restrictions here than a lot of other parts of the country. And as you said, we're drawing a lot of people, not just because of our weather, but this perception that, you know, we've all seen it. Miami's open, Florida's open. So people come down here to vacation. I know because I live on Miami Beach and I see it, you know, firsthand, right? So that is the context here when you're talking about potential public health restrictions. Even if, you know, B117, this more contagious strain of the variant or this more contagious variant of the virus is spreading rapidly in Florida and we're not seeing an uptick in cases for whatever reason. Maybe it's because we've had so much spread of the virus already that it's not taking a hold like it would in other parts of the country. The concern becomes, is this state going to be an incubator for those mutations? So that's part of the conversation.
What are the current CDC travel guidelines, the recommendations?
Their recommendations, generally speaking, are to wear a mask while you're in public, especially while you're indoors, I would imagine, while traveling. The Biden administration did issue an executive order that the TSA is implementing. So that's not quite the CDC, but the Transportation Security Administration is implementing this, you know, these mask requirements. Basically that you have to wear a mask while you're traveling. That's the way I've seen it described, but the testing requirement, I believe, is still just being discussed at this point. It's not actually, although a lot of airlines are requiring COVID tests.
You've mentioned this B117 strain. This is the so-called UK strain, named because it was first kind of found in the United Kingdom. What's the status of that variant in Florida? How far wide is it spreading?
Right. So that's a great question. So, you know, the way you look for this mutation is by something called genetic sequencing, where you're examining the actual RNA structure of this virus. And that's a really expensive and time-consuming process. So a lot of what we have are estimates, right? We have a random sampling, and then we also have a skewed sampling done by this particular testing company. So it gets kind of weedsy here, but to boil it down, there is a testing company that does about, you know, 20,000 tests per week here in Florida. And they can tell when someone tests positive, they have a pretty good indication of whether it was a case caused by this variant, because there's a three-pronged positive response and only two of the three prongs light up if it's a variant case. So what they then do is ship those samples down a road to a lab they're partnering with and sequence it and confirm the B117 cases. So what we've had here is a mixture of public health officials sequencing and private lab companies flagging these cases. And to boil it down, how prevalent is it? All we can do is say educated guess. It was introduced here, we know, late last year, and it could be accounting for about 15% of the cases right now. Scientists are pretty much in agreement here that by, you know, a month from now, it's going to be the predominant strain.
the CDC has warned by March, this UK strain will be the predominant strain of coronavirus, COVID-19, in the United States, not just Florida, but nationwide.
Right. And, you know, we'll see if that bears out as true across the country. But we know at this point, it looks almost certain that it's going to bear out in Florida. And Florida has become, you know, a hotbed, so to speak, of this particular variant.
What about these other variants we've been hearing about, the South African variant and the Brazilian strain?
Right. So, you know, we still have not had any confirmed cases of those variants, although both have been discovered in the U.S. The Brazilian one, I think, is particularly concerning and something I have my eye on as a reporter in Miami. It's because of our travel patterns, Tom, right? So we have so many Brazilians living in South Florida, and, you know, the flights aren't shut down to U.S. citizens, so you still have some activity there. And also it contains this mutation called the immune escape mutation. The immune escape mutation basically, it suggests some level of neutralizing antibody activity decreases with this variant. What that means is still an open question, right? It could make vaccines slightly less potent. It could just mean that perhaps if you were infected with the original strain early on in the pandemic and you encounter this new variant, you're more likely to get a reinfection. What that reinfection looks like, we're still not quite sure about, right? Could it be an asymptomatic reinfection? Could it be severe disease? So there's so many unknowns about these variants. But one thing we do know is that there's early data to suggest that there's some kind of different interaction it has with our immune system than the original strain. And that has scientists very concerned about the implications for vaccines.
So much unsettled science still as we are 1 year into the pandemic, unsettled science regarding these new strains. And of course, lots of questions about generally COVID-19 and reporting for healthcare, and also the conversation of the Biden administration talking about travel rules. Ben Konark is a reporter with the Miami Herald. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, business leaders in Florida, especially Central Florida, say they'll oppose travel restrictions. They call their position fragile as tourists are just now starting to return here to the Sunshine State. And they understand that this virus variant is a threat to business, too, but say they can't survive another lockdown and no visitors. I spoke about it with Ashley Kreitzer of the Tampa Bay Business Journal. Ashley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. Happy to be back.
Good to have you on the show. So Governor DeSantis is already fundraising off this talk of possible travel restrictions imposed on Florida, calling it a political attack. As the political rhetoric escalates, let's talk about what this might mean, an actual travel ban to Florida during the pandemic, what that would mean for a state that is starting to see tourism return, particularly in Central Florida. What are you hearing about? Any concern over a potential ban on travel here?
I think this could potentially be devastating to hospitality in Central Florida and the Tampa Bay region. You're right, we are seeing tourism start to return. We're starting to see tourists come, particularly from the Northeast, the Midwest, where they've been much more heavily locked down than we are here in Florida. And they're coming, they're filling our hotels, they're spending money in our restaurants, our retailers. And if that stops, that's going to be potentially devastating to a lot of folks who are depending on that tourism revenue.
And what's the response from business leaders you're talking to about the potential of this COVID-19 variant spreading in this state? That is not good for business either.
It's not. I think everyone very much wants to remain open. There are a lot of folks convinced that they can do business safely, whether it's eating indoors, whether it's having their hotel open, theme parks. There's a lot of folks who do believe that they can operate safely even with the new variant spreading. So I think that at all costs, business owners want to remain open.
We do need to stress White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki is saying no decision has been made about domestic travel. But Florida, you know, does lead the nation in the number of known cases of this variant of the virus. It is more contagious. So what do you think the contingency plan would be? If the worst happens and businesses are faced once again with visitors to Florida slowing down?
Well, that's already happened once, right? They've already been through a shutdown last spring. So it has happened. And Florida as a state is still open. And even if travel shuts down, Florida presumably would remain open for residents. And residents have been very mobile throughout the state. They've been doing vacations. They've been visiting the theme park. So I don't think it's great. Like I said, I think it's potentially devastating. But it's, at this point, they've been through it before, a version of it.
Let's talk about the theme parks in particular, Disney, Universal, just how critical it is for them right now that visitors keep coming steadily into the spring and summer months. What are you hearing from executives in that part of the state about all of this?
So the fascinating part about Central Florida's tourism economy is that when you hear Orlando, you think the Mouse, you think SeaWorld, you think the theme parks, but it's really driven by the group business, by business at the convention center, by big corporate conventions who are in turn drawn there by the theme parks, but they're coming there, first of all, for the group business, for those conventions and meetings, whether it's the Wisconsin Dairy Farmers Association or a corporate board meeting that then has some days at the theme park. So most of the Orlando hospitality market is actually driven by group business, which means families coming down is great. But until corporate America returns to those types of trips, Orlando is probably faring the worst of any hospitality market in the state, even with travel open as it is.
The worst, really, even as jobless claims are finally ticking down. Still a pretty dire picture.
That's what my sources tell me on the hotel investment side. I wrote a story this week about investors starting to circle Florida hotel properties because they're outperforming hotels in the rest of the country. And Orlando in particular, if you're looking at Florida as a whole, things are starting to pick back up. But Orlando is probably the hardest hit at this point.
But the entire state still suffering, right? I mean, We are by no means out of the woods, although Central Florida is sort of the epicenter of this concern.
Right. Central Florida is the epicenter because they are so tourism dependent. But sitting here in downtown Tampa, where we just hosted the Super Bowl and a boat parade yesterday and hotels and restaurants were full, I can tell you at least this past week here in Tampa was almost as if there was no pandemic. There's no restrictions on anything. Folks are out and about and streets are as crowded as they've ever been. Sure, things are not back to 2019. Nothing is normal, but like I said, it's not quite the widespread devastation that everyone anticipated.
Let's touch quickly on the aftermath of the Super Bowl in Tampa Bay. There was concern about maskless partiers. As you look at the aftermath of all of that, what are folks in the Tampa Bay region saying this week?
So I think the conversation is as polarizing as the pandemic. There are people who are horrified by the images and the public health ramifications, and there are people who are very excited by those images of crowds because they believe that they underscore the difference between Florida and the Northeast or Florida and the Midwest and California, and they believe those images say, we're open for business. Look what you can do here that you can't do elsewhere. So unfortunately, this public health crisis has become very polarizing, and we need to acknowledge, I think, that there are folks on both sides of that fence.
Ashley Kreitzer with the Tampa Bay Business Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program this week, a Florida mayor who wants help from the Biden administration and student mental health 3 years after Parkland and during the pandemic. Be sure to check out our podcast by searching Florida Roundup on your favorite podcast app, and be sure to hit subscribe. Thanks. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
Well, this week, Florida mayors sent up a cry for help. Both Republican and Democratic leaders around the state say this pandemic is simply crushing Florida's cities. And they're begging Congress to pass the Biden administration's rescue plan as soon as possible. I spoke about it with Mayor Rick Kreisman of St. Petersburg. Mayor Kreisman, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you today.
You know, you joined with the Republican mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, to publish an op-ed basically begging Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott in Congress to pass President Biden's rescue plan. You're saying the situation is desperate for Florida's communities. There is immense suffering in this pandemic. Tell us what you're witnessing and dealing with in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll get to the city itself last, because obviously, you know, as mayor, my focus is on my community, the health of my community, and the economic health of my community. And, you know, what this plan, the American Rescue Plan of the president does is that it really addresses both of those issues. From the standpoint of the health of my community, you know, there's significant funding that's put in for a national vaccination program. We need to get people vaccinated. The quickest way for us to get to the end of this pandemic, to the light at the end of this tunnel, is through vaccinations. And so, you know, this provides the resources that we think are really necessary to help speed up the process of getting the vaccine into all of our communities, not only in the state of Florida, but throughout the entire country. It also, you know, talks about the testing and making sure that that we're getting the testing and the contract tracing that's needed. And so the funding is provided for that. You know, there's the funding that's needed to make sure our schools are able to be reopened and reopened safely, and that the teachers aren't having to worry, and the students and the parents of those students aren't having to worry. And so, you know, these are critical needs. And then, of course, from the economic standpoint, providing the resources for so many families who are struggling right now, where they've either had one or both parents or one parent that's been out of work, and providing that additional $1,400 would make a huge difference. Providing a longer period of time for unemployment compensation to be paid. Providing resources for our small businesses. I can tell you in St. Petersburg, our small businesses are what make our city special. And we've had so many of our businesses that have really been struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And so the resources that are provided as a part of this act obviously will impact them. And then, of course, last is us as a city. And Mayor Suarez and I both, you know, our cities, along with other cities all over the country, we're being impacted like businesses are. Our revenues are down. The cost that we've had to spend for overtime and other expenses that are directly COVID related, none of them were budgeted or were in our budgets. And so our budgets are all taking hits.
Yeah.
And so these funds are really, really critical.
Yeah, you're saying that every penny in this plan, you believe, is needed. And you've partnered with a Republican mayor in Florida to make that case. You're saying government needs to go big, and that we don't need to worry about the cost. Is that something that you think both Republicans and Democrats in Florida agree on right now?
Well, certainly, you know, we always worry about the cost, but but there comes a point where you're having to weigh what's the cost of inaction versus action. And I think our feeling is, is that the cost of inaction is far worse than the cost of action. If we don't take these actions and we don't go big, the long-term impact on our individual communities, on our state, on our country, we think will be significant. And I think that's a mistake that commonly happens, is we look short-term and we say, okay, if we do this, what's the short-term implications? And yes, you know, is it going to have a negative impact on our spending? Of course it will. It's trillions of dollars here. But the long-term implications are far better, because, you know, having these businesses that survive, having people that continue to have jobs, versus the cost of trying to, take care of millions of people who would be potentially out of work, of projects and infrastructure that gets ignored and becomes more costly to take care of down the road, that I think the long-term implications are far worse if we don't take action and we don't think big.
You're making this plea directly to Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott and their colleagues in Congress. How do you expect them to vote on the president's plan?
Well, I mean, of course, I have how I would like them to vote, how I hope they'll vote. And I hope my expectation isn't realized. I unfortunately expect that neither of them would support it. I hope I'm wrong on that. I hope they're willing to put partisanship aside, as we have done, and Mayor Suarez and I have done, and recognizing that this is bigger than what party you're a member of. There comes a point in time where it's about the country and about the people that they represent, every man and woman in the state of Florida. And that should be more important than, you know, is this a Republican policy or a Democratic policy? It's American policy.
Let me ask you, Mayor Kreisman, do these times call for Republicans to set aside their commitment to small government? Are you saying that these times call for robust government because there's simply no other choice?
I think there are times when that's the case. And I think it's fair that the Republicans look in the mirror and ask themselves, you know, when they were looking at some of the tax cuts that were implemented, did they ask the same questions? Were they sharing the same concerns about the budget as some are expressing now? So I think there's two things that have to happen. I think they do need to look in the mirror and ask themselves those questions, but they also have to ask, you know, in times of emergencies, in times where, you know, we're dealing, whether it's, a category five hurricane, a natural disaster, or something like this, where it's a pandemic that hasn't happened in, you know, 100 years, is this that one of those times where we have to say, you know what, we've got to put aside what we normally believe to be the case and do what we have to do to help the American people? And I think this is certainly one of those times.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, Mayor Rick Kreisman, the mayor of St. Petersburg, with us via Zoom. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Three years ago Saturday, a gunman killed 17 people and hurt 17 others at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. The shooting sparked protests, student activism, and led to hundreds of millions of dollars spent on security measures at public schools throughout Florida. A grand jury that has been examining school safety since the shooting called the state's mental health system a mess, with shortcomings turning up, quote, everywhere like bad pennies. That interim report was released late last year. The mental health system now also has the pandemic to deal with, and hundreds of thousands of students trying to learn from home on a screen, not in a classroom. Educational years that have been marked by code red practices and active shooter drills now include days, weeks, or even a year or more away from the traditional classroom. The education crisis for Florida's vulnerable students is the focus of a reporting project, Class of COVID-19. It brings together public media reporters from across the state reporting stories about how COVID-19 is affecting public education. Katie Swatowski-Munoz is a reporter at WLRN in South Florida. She joins us now. Katie, how is the Parkland community marking this anniversary of the shooting?
Well, the community is doing things that they do every year. It's sort of a tradition to get together in Pine Trails Park and commemorate the lives of the people that were killed. But it's going to look a little different this year because of the pandemic, as I'm sure you can imagine. So people that do come are encouraged to wear masks. And there's going to be a streaming option for people that don't feel comfortable going to the park in person this year, but still want to pray along with the community, watch the video, commemorate the people that they've lost, their friends or former classmates or, you know, those kind of things. And then the school district is also continuing its volunteering efforts. This past week, the school district has been encouraging schools to encourage students to volunteer, whether that's feeding first responders or landscaping. These physical things, even during the pandemic, again, masked, distanced, but these are now sort of traditions every year around this time.
Yeah, sad traditions at that because of this type of anniversary. So much has changed in 3 years, and yet it's only been 3 years, and the pain is still fresh for so many in that community. How has the school district changed how it approaches student mental health in the aftermath of this shooting?
I can tell you the school district has changed how it approached student mental health during the pandemic quite a bit. So, you know, I can't say that this specifically has to do with the shooting, but it is a positive that's come out of this pandemic. So they have a whole bunch of new programs to provide mental health to provide mental health care to students during the pandemic. And so you've got a parent university on mental health care resources online that parents can access. You've got a happiness pilot program at some schools. You've got a talk application that connects students to therapy through their online schooling portal. So you have things that for a school district that's seen unspeakable tragedy, they've really upped their game on mental health resources, especially during this pandemic.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. We're talking about the upcoming third anniversary of the tragic shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. That happens this coming weekend. Katie Sotalski-Munoz is with us, reporter at WLRN. Katie, what kind of changes in resources for student mental health have been in play in Broward County schools, either because of the shooting or because of the pandemic?
So I got to speak with Superintendent Robert Runcie a few weeks ago, specifically about student mental health. And one of the things that we talked about was sort of looking back at the district before the shooting happened 3 years ago, and that the district really was trying to be proactive about mental health then. But it really didn't matter because the shooting really took precedent in this community and changed everything. Certainly after the shooting, we saw an increase in funding for mental health. There's a lot of people that say there still, of course, needs to be more, but there certainly is much more now in terms of people ready to help students directly than there were before the shooting happened.
For the Class of COVID-19 Reporting Project, which gathered together a number of Florida public media reporters, including yourself, Katie, you spoke with Stoneman Douglas Senior Eden Samara and Sarah Lerner, who teaches English and is the yearbook advisor at the school. Let's listen to what they told you.
The first 2 weeks of quarantine were kind of similar to the first 2 weeks that we got off of school after the shooting in a way, but there is one major difference that definitely defined everything for me, and that was being with people. We had each other to lean on, and with the pandemic, it was complete isolation, like quite literally from the very beginning.
Now, I am the mental health counselor for my children, my own children. I am a sounding board for my students. I have become the IT department in my house.
It just underscores how difficult it is to teach during all of this. And I think it really showed me how exhausted people are. Because, you know, everyone since the pandemic, the key word has been pivot, right? Everyone's trying to pivot somehow. But for these teachers and students, they've been pivoting for 3 years. And so Sarah Lerner told me the story about how her students really wanted her to teach Macbeth. And normally you're in a classroom, people get assigned parts, you read out loud, you're with each other. And Sarah was telling me she's just really not excited to do that this year because she's talking to a black screen. Her students have their cameras off. She, you know, it's hard to act when you can't get anything back from students. And what kind of experience do students get reading Macbeth if they're all just black squares on a Zoom or Teams call? So I think that really showed me it's just that the pandemic is making things that much harder. This problem existed before. People were still healing before this pandemic. But the pandemic has made it so much harder to connect. And people are tired.
You can see all of the reporting, listen to the reporting, read the reporting for Class of COVID at classofcovid.org. and on many Florida public television stations, a TV program, which will air the week of February 22nd. Be sure to check your local listings for that. Again, the website, classofcovid.org. Now, Katie, I know this week the news continues as it relates even to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. There was a court ruling that was related to the shooting and the school district. What was this about?
So there's a host of civil lawsuits going on in court in Broward County that are not related to the big case of the state of Florida versus the confessed shooter. But these civil suits are parents and family members of victims looking for accountability, whether that's from law enforcement or, in this case, the Broward County School District. And this week, a ruling came down from Judge Patty Englander Henning. It was a significant loss for the Parkland victims' family members and a victory for the Broward County School Board, because the ruling basically said that the Broward County School District cannot be held liable for not warning teachers or students or anyone about the gunman's disturbing behavior. So what that really means, if you break it down, is that the school district didn't have a responsibility to warn anybody about the scary behavior they were seeing from the confessed gunman.
WLRN's Katie Swetalski-Munoz, reporter for a member station in South Florida. Thank you, Katie.
Thanks, Tom.
You can hear the entire conversation with the Parkland students and teacher at classofcovid.org. It's part of the project across the state of Florida with Florida public media reporters throughout the Sunshine State, Class of COVID-19, an education crisis for Florida's vulnerable students. Radio reports, articles, and the television program, which will be on the week of February 22nd. Be sure to check your local listings for your PBS station.
Still to come, how did a Florida city's water almost get poisoned? That's next. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
We're back on the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, how about this, Tom? It sounds like science fiction, but it actually happened last week. A computer hacker got into the control system of a water treatment plant in Oldsmar, that's near Tampa. Now, the hacker tried to poison the water by increasing a chemical normally used to treat water. A supervisor spotted the cybercrime in progress and stopped it. But the whole thing highlights the vulnerability of these systems. Christopher Krebs led the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency for the Trump administration. He told the House Homeland Security Committee the federal government needs to invest in training for local government employees and needs to make sure that municipal computer systems are up to date.
Oldsmar is probably the rule rather than the exception, and that is not their fault. These are municipal utilities that do not have sufficient resources to have robust security programs. That's just the way it goes.
Bradley George is a reporter and anchor at WUSF, our sister station in Tampa. He joins us now. Bradley, how did this hacker, first of all, gain entry into this computer system?
Well, from what we know, Tom, they remoted in, just as maybe you or I would remote into a computer as we're working from home. Apparently, that's something that Oldsmar city employees had been doing. The first login that happened around 8 a.m. Last Friday morning, the people who were monitoring the water treatment plant didn't really think much of it because they thought it was one of their fellow employees who got in. And then the second time around 1:30 is more problematic when whoever this intruder was actually got into some of the control systems on that computer and increased the level of sodium hydroxide, which is also known as lye, that's used to treat the water, and raised it to a pretty dangerous level.
Yeah. So walk us through what you've been able to learn about this hacker getting into the system in the afternoon. And what, just being able to virtually turn up a dial on some kind of chemical?
That's essentially how it works. And fortunately, there was a city employee who was monitoring that system. And so as soon as the intruder increased the level of lie, that employee was able to bring it back down to a safe level. So there was no impact on the water supply or any harm to people's health.
Did that additional chemical ever get into the water?
From what city officials have said, no, because they have several other processes and places along the way where they could take it out or notice if there was an increase.
I see. And so how did this supervisor spot this? Were they just monitoring, what, the computer monitor and maybe seeing this chemical spike up?
Well, they were seeing the mouse pointer move around. That was indicative that somebody had logged into the system and then saw that they opened this control panel and had increased the level of lie.
And so what did the supervisor then shut things down, or how did that operate?
Apparently, the intruder left the system. The supervisor, whoever this employee was able to get the sodium hydroxide back down to a safe level. And that's when they alerted law enforcement. Now, that was on Friday afternoon. We didn't learn about this until Monday morning when Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri held a press conference and said that this happened.
And what have we learned since then about details of not only the danger posed to this water supply, but the investigation into who or what was behind this hack?
Well, the Associated Press reported a story. They found a advisory that the state of Massachusetts had issued to its water utilities. According to that advisory, the computer system in Oldsmar was running Windows 7, which is an obsolete version of Windows.
Yeah.
There was no firewall to protect it from general internet traffic. And apparently multiple city employees were using the same login and password to get into the system. Now, the AP tried to contact Oldsmar city officials to get them to comment. They didn't comment on it. The FBI, which is involved in the investigation, didn't comment on it either. But that's what we found out. And apparently this was serious enough that that water utilities in other states are looking at this and perhaps changing the way that they've set up some of these computer systems.
So as city officials, other infrastructure agencies maybe review cybersecurity, this reminder, you know, the three keys here potentially, which may have been at play in Oldsmar, outdated operating system, right? So the computer system is not being updated with the latest security patches. You've got, multiple people using the same user and password. That violates, you know, normal protocol. And then, of course, the lack of a firewall, which would violate normal cyber protocol. So what is kind of the state, what do we know about the state of cybersecurity, particularly at this water treatment plant? And what can that tell us? Maybe what officials are telling us or other cybersecurity experts are saying about the vulnerabilities of these infrastructure agencies?
Well, it's interesting because Christopher Krebs, who's a well-regarded cybersecurity expert, he worked in the Trump administration and then President Trump fired him towards the end of his time in office. Testified in front of the House Homeland Security Committee this week, and he was actually answering a question from Val Demings of Orlando, who asked specifically about what happened in Oldsmar. And he said, you know, you can't really fault the city because basically every local government deals with this problem. Every local government, you know, has issues with technology, and they don't have the money to fix it. State governments don't have the money for it. Of course, we know about all the different IT problems that Florida's state government has had with the unemployment system and other things. We've had other cities in Florida that have had issues with ransomware attacks and the like. So Krebs is saying that really there needs to be a federal intervention here, that the federal government needs to step up and help pay for some of the improvements to these systems and pay to train municipal employees to recognize the signs of a potential cyber attack.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We're speaking with anchor and reporter from WUSF in Tampa, Bradley George, about a story that happened on Friday, a week ago, but yet we didn't learn about it until earlier this week on Monday, an attempted, I don't even know if you can call it an attempted, Bradley, it was a successful hack of a computer system of the water treatment facility in Oldsmar, Florida, near Tampa. Successful in that the hacker got in and moved some of the water chemistry around, unsuccessful in terms of literally poisoning the water. The water is safe. What kind of precautions are being put in place now?
From what we know, we haven't heard a whole lot from the city of Oldsmar since this this press conference on Monday. But apparently they've made some changes to this remote login system where you can't get into it now. There's also a question of who was behind this, and we don't know. We're waiting on some kind of update from the Pinellas County Sheriff or the FBI or the Secret Service. Christopher Krebs, in his testimony before that House committee this week, he said, you know, it might have been a disgruntled employee. It might not be some kind of sophisticated cyber attack from a foreign actor. It might have been something simple as that. So we don't know a whole lot right now about how the city has responded to this. I know, looking on the city's social media pages and also looking at some of the response we've gotten to our reporting on this, a lot of folks who live in Oldsmar were upset that the city didn't essentially say anything for the entire weekend. And it still isn't clear why there was this gap between the time that the city reported this to the sheriff's office and Pinellas Sheriff Bob Gualtieri had this press conference on Monday morning where they announced what happened.
The law enforcement agencies, how do they describe the relative sophistication of this break-in? Because, you know, I don't know a whole lot about computers, but it sounds potentially relatively simple with a username and password, maybe.
That's right. I mean, they haven't said much about the sophistication of it at all. And again, from what we know from this Associated Press report, apparently it was fairly easy for someone to get into this system because it's running an outdated version of Windows. There's no firewall. There is a password that's shared among multiple city employees, and that's something that maybe gets passed around in other sections as well. So there's just not a whole lot that we know about who's behind this until we hear more from law enforcement.
Lots of questions still yet to be answered in this particular case, but in the background, or maybe even foreground of all this, is cybersecurity. Florida's history of cybersecurity as a place targeted by international hackers. We've seen this with other Florida city computer systems hacked, Riviera Beach, Lake City. And then the FBI has told us that at least one Florida county had its voter registration system accessed during the buildup to the 2016 presidential election, not tampered with, but at least poked at. And so how does all of this kind of get processed, but as law enforcement now deals with this latest system with a break-in of a really critical, you know, utility, a water system?
Well, I think it's a problem for every state, not just for Florida. And that really came through listening to this House committee this week. I know this isn't really a time for bipartisanship in Washington, but you had Republicans and Democrats on that committee pretty united in saying, look, we need to do something to give states and local governments the tools that they need to defend from this kind of attack. So I would expect perhaps to see some kind of legislation, maybe some kind of effort from the Biden administration to provide those tools to states sometime in the next few months or so.
Bradley George has been our guest. He is an anchor and reporter at WUSF reporting on this cyber intrusion, to put it politely. It was a cyber crime of the water utility computer system in Oldsmar, Florida, near Tampa, on Friday last week. Bradley, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And that's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and we get technical advice each and every week from Peter Merritt. Engineering help, which is awfully important, from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a safe and happy Valentine's Day. We'll be back next Friday.